on Pro Tips when I was telling you about this book that I've been reading called American Comics, A History?
I do.
By Jeremy Dauber.
Yes, I do remember that book. Yes. Are you still plowing through it?
I'm a couple chapters from the end. I was starting to get a little bit nervous because there was a lot of chapters to go. And this guy was getting into the 2000s, right?
So here's where I thought this was going. You're like, I'm almost at the end. It turns out Bruce Wayne is Batman.
His parents were killed. Who could have seen that coming? But it started to come on. It, like most comics histories that I've read so far, kind of peter out around the 90s, right? They talk about Image Comics, and then it's kind of a quick slide home. But this guy, I'm telling you, if you're a comics fan, you've got to read this book. Not only has he gone into, obviously, he started out with single panel American political comics and all the way up through newspaper comic strips, comic books. He had a really deep dive on the underground comics movement, comics with an X.
Yep.
This guy has done it all. He's covered everything. And that's what had me worried. Because he's done it all. He's covered everything, and he's getting into the 2000s. That's us. That's you and me and a bunch of other web cartoonists, right? And I start to get that old familiar feeling. It's like, is he gonna blank us? Is he gonna mention web comics? And if he does, is he gonna do it right? And I was getting edgy.
Now, listeners at home, you'll notice that Brad's heart is a flutter at about what's about to happen. Oh, will Brad get asked to the dance? You're wondering. Will Brad be stood up at the altar? What will happen for Brad Geiger? Tune in next week when we talk about. Is Brad forgotten by history?
Yes, that's exactly. And I was getting edgy, and I was talking to my son about it because it's like, he said, if my son goes, "What are you so worried about?" I said, two things: either he's going to not mention it at all, or he's going to mention it, and he ain't going to do it right. Right?
Right, because it'll come across like this. The hero of the era was Dave Kellett, who had a co-conspirator junior partner named Brad Geiger.
Well, you're half right. Guess who gets name dropped in American history of, or I'm sorry, in American comics, a history? Guess who gets name dropped?
Was it Brad Geiger, ladies and gentlemen?
It's a young Mr. David Kellett, whose Sheldon comics gets a special call out in the section where they're talking about webcomics.
I will admit that my heart did a little extra beat right there, Bradley.
Yes. I was starting to get a little bit of a good feeling because all of a sudden this guy, Jeremy Dauber, starts talking about Erica Mohan. Erica Mohan gets a real, because he kind of starts with a big propensity for auto-bio comics in the early 2000s.
So he leans that way, yeah.
He spends a lot of time talking about Erica's early work. And very, you know, I love the way this guy uses language, but does a really good job of discussing that. And then all of
like
a sudden,
Erica's titled Dar, that one?
Yep.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
And then there's also a lot of talk about some of the other standouts. You know, Kate Beaton, of course, gets a mention because, you know, that you can't talk about webcomics and not mention her. Penny Arcade, of course, gets a mention. Our friend David Melky gets a mention. And then all of a sudden, Dave Kellett gets a mention.
America's sweetheart, Dave Kellett takes the stage. And did it talk about my strapping 48-inch biceps? What did it mention? How did it describe me?
He must have been talking about some of your comics that had to do with literary figures because he said something like, the things that you do to Emily Dickinson shouldn't be allowed. It was a sentence that was like that.
What? The things that you've done to Emily Dickinson's work.
Should not be allowed.
All right. Well, I have made a few fair shots at Emily Dickinson, even though I love Emily Dickinson. But okay. Oh, you know, I accept
this is,
it.
This is beautiful. This is exactly what would happen to me. Because now it's you have gone. This is exactly what. Because you've gone from, oh my God, it's so great to be mentioned, to, well, he didn't get that right at all.
Well, hold on. He didn't mention that I can bench press 300 pounds, and that doesn't seem fair.
But the good news is that when I heard Erica and Melky and Kellett, then I knew that this person was doing his own work. I mean, those are some, obviously there's one that he left out. That is a little bit of a ding, but overall, the research this person did into the subject matter is fantastic.
Now, listener at home, we're going to take a break here to remind you, Brad Geiger is not happy with this outcome. I will point out that Brad Geiger wanted to hear the name Brad Geiger. Geiger is still listening to this audiobook going, this son of a bitch, this rascally son of a bitch hasn't mentioned Brad Geiger. So let's keep listening, friends. Let's tune back into the podcast and see if Brad Geiger's name gets mentioned.
And as I was picking up where I left off, it's not over, though. I've still got two more chapters. There's still two more chapters.
Hope against hope.
He could still slide it in at the very end. He could say, and so, ladies and gentlemen, that is American Comics in History. By the way, Brad Geiger is awesome. Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody. Never let that flickering candle of hope be snuffed, Brad. Let it shine brightly. And on that note, I'm going to say hello, everybody, and welcome to Comic Lab, the show about making comics and being recognized for it.
And making a living from comics and being recognized for it. I'm Brad Geiger, the editor of webcomics.com and the creator of Evil Inc.
And I'm his pal, famous cartoonist, Dave
Kellen. Notable. David, notable. You're notable.
Mentionable cartoonist, Dave yes. Kellen, cartoonist of Drive and Sheldon and co-director of Stripped.
Which I guess makes me unmentionable. And this week's Hour of Comics Advice is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab. So Dave. Let's talk comics.
Let's talk comics, my friend. We have a really fun show. I'm genuinely excited about this. Brad and I were laying it out before we jumped on here. And I got to tell you, it's a fun one. But I got to remind everybody that this show is going out live right now to our Patreon pals and friends over at patreon.com/comiclab at the live gab level. You can watch the show streaming live every week and watch Brad's face get increasingly red as he talks about his unmentionable name, which cannot go into cartoon history books. So join us over at patreon.com/comiclab at the live gab level.
And this show is brought to you by our good friends at Wacom, at WACOM, the makers of the powerful professional portable Wacom One. That's a wonderful digital tablet that both Dave and I both use in our daily lives as professional cartoonists, one of which even gets mentioned in the history books. It did not mention, by the way, Dave, that you are a user of the Wacom One, another place that hopefully will get brought up in the second edition of this tome, but one that should be mentioned by many of us, because I'm telling you, that Wacom One allows us to do powerful professional work no matter where we are.
The book did mention my winning smile multiple times, though, yes. And said, like, as he's using his Wacom One, that winning smile is what has made him a huge mentionable for this book.
huge mentionable.
So we give a huge shout out and a thanks to our friends over at Wacom at WACOM.com, makers of the Wacom One. And I got to tell you, it's been a huge help and a guidepost for my own career. So I thank them for sponsoring the show. They are a critical, critical part of what I do. So thank you, guys.
All right. So, Dave, this week on the show, I wanted to talk about something that came across my Twitter feed not so long ago. And it's a person that is basically making an announcement that they're quitting comics. Okay. And they list through the reasons why. Now, before we go into it, I'm going to read the Twitter thread. He goes for quite a bit talking about what he's been going through for the past several years. I want to just make a note right up front. We're not going to talk about the person's name. We're not going to identify them. And when we discuss this, we're not going to discuss this person's specific situation. But there are, I count three major topics that he talks about that we talk about on the show all the time. And those are worthy of discussion. So we're not going to talk about this person. We're going to talk about these three overarching components of his situation that has led him to leave comics, and some things that I think we could learn from.
Right. The point being not to throw anyone under the bus.
No.
But because this person has shared this publicly, we wanted to take this as a jumping off point to have a broader, deeper, more generalized discussion. That is not an attack on this one person. It's just it's basically a launching point, because there could be 100 names that we could substitute in here and you'd go, oh, yeah, now I see who it is, because it doesn't really matter. We've all faced certain crises like the person that is facing in this Twitter thread. So, Brad, why don't you jump us in here?
Right. So it starts like this. I'm quitting comics. This isn't a rushed decision. It's a culmination of months of deliberation. I've tried to be a full-time comic artist since I finished college. It's been a 9-year journey of highs and lows. Oh, and by the way, I'll just tell you right up front, I'm paraphrasing in places. I'm skipping around partly so because I want to make it a little bit harder to identify this person. Right. But he says, I was blessed with the support of my family and my then girlfriend, who is now my wife. He says, I've worked on small indie comics, a successful Kickstarter, and I did my fair share of cons doing portfolio reviews. I'm going to put a pause there. I looked into it, the successful Kickstarter. It doesn't look like he ran the Kickstarter. He was somebody whose work was used in a book that was kickstarted. It looks like by another person.
Which is a key detail. That's a key detail.
Yep. He did not run the Kickstarter. He did not run, but his work was used as part of the Kickstarter. From what I can see, because I wanted to make sure I knew it was going to come up in the topic.
Right.
Going back to quoting, I wanted to create my own series and get them published. Worked with a lot of wonderful people, got great responses to my art, but I never really broke the glass ceiling of getting my own series picked up or any big gigs by a big publisher. A certain comic convention was the first sign that made me think I was reaching my end game. I got no portfolio reviews, some great reactions to my art from writers, but overall, my investment in it bore no returns. I got tired of spending my family's money in trips with no return. I worked in small books and had the pleasure of everyone I worked in these 9 years being nothing short of phenomenal. Many became my closest friends. The straw that broke the camel's back was the end of 2021, starting another year with no prospect of a full-time gig, no financial autonomy, having my wife carry us both through every month gnawed at my brain. Plus, my mental health pushed me to consider all of this. I had two very important moments that helped me make my decision. One was talking with another artist working in the big leagues that will remain anonymous. The other one was an out of nowhere chance to draw a book for a big publisher that went nowhere. The talk made me realize I'd spent these past years, especially the last three, working in projects that gave me no future. It made me realize how I will never be able to work for a big publisher. I'm incapable of finishing a book on a monthly basis. It's true, I never had to, but I always strive for the best I could do, and the best I can do takes too long to make. So essentially, I realized my glass ceiling, and I was never going to break through it soon enough. And in these 3 years, the only thing I was doing, I would end up completely spent after even one issue of it. How could I do a monthly or a mini series then? All right. So then he talks about this thing that was the straw that broke the camel's back for him. And it basically boils down to this. He had a huge shot at working for one of these people that he says is in the big leagues, one of these big publishers. It was a tight deadline. And in the 11th hour, the deal fell through. It didn't materialize. And instead of being upset about it, he says he was relieved. He was relieved. He didn't have to do this. He didn't have to hit the deadline. He didn't have to do all that work, all those compositions. He was relieved. So that brings us to here as he's closing. He says, hey, I'm good enough to do at what I do. I'm really good. It took me a lot of family, friends, and therapy to get myself to realize that, but I'm good. So the relief at knowing that I didn't have to do what I apparently loved the most was eye-opening. At the same time, he says his wife was reaching the breaking point, too. And they had one of those heart-to-heart talks.
Sure.
And
sure.
She was like, hey, can we really afford to keep doing this? And he had already decided, no, he's leaving comics. He's taking some courses to do something else that is art related, but is not comics. He closes by saying this. I love comics. Every cell in my body is made of that art form. I can't give it up. I'll just find another way to do it. One where I don't have to worry about making a living out of it. One where my biggest worry is to share how much I love for the art form. Comics didn't break my heart. I guess that this is a good thing of getting older. You realize that the more that matters to you, that dreams are just what you have when you sleep. and your ambitions only end when you give up. And I couldn't be more excited about it. So that's the Twitter thread. And again, I jumped around, I paraphrased, but that's what he's talking about here. This is what his last 9 years has led him to. And I ask you, Dave Kellett, what is your reaction to that?
So whenever I encounter, because it's not just this person, whenever I encounter someone who has put all of their childhood dreams into making it into the quote unquote big leagues, whether it's The New Yorker or Marvel or Anders McNeil or whatever it is in terms of what they thought as a 10-year-old a cartoonist was, and then they find out that it's not working, my reaction is always the same. It's always like, Brad, I've tried nothing and it's not working. Because it's like, read the tea leaves. For the last 30 years, that hasn't been working.
Oh,
you've got to own and control your own career. It's everything we talk about on this show, which is that we've had friends, by the way, Brad, who break into the big leagues. They're like, I finally am on a DC title. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, I'm not making enough money. And oh this my God, horrible. This workload is ridiculous. And my hand hurts and my back hurts. And so like even having grasped the brass ring, they're like, oh, geez, it's made out of chalk, you know, like that kind of thing. So there's a lot to unpack there because I feel tremendously for this person where they are, but it feels like the first step of almost like a 12 step of like the realization that there's a problem. But unfortunately, it's this person is choosing to walk away. Whereas I would say having looked at their work, you have the skills, you have the chops.
Yes.
Now apply it to owning and controlling your own career. Like do everything that we've been talking about for years, which is to not invest in some editor putting a little magical sword on both of your shoulders and saying, now you are a knight of the realm, but going out and doing your own thing. You know,
that's the first thing I want to talk about. And in fact, you just reminded me there's four topics that come up in this thread. Okay. And we're going to talk about the first one that you just mentioned. And again, as of right now, we're no longer talking about this person. We're talking about ideas that this person shares with a whole lot of other people that we've got to talk about. Right. So we're no longer talking about him. But I will say this, the big situation right off the bat is what Dave noticed. This whole idea of a big publisher, you see it over and over. Big portfolio reviews, big gigs, the big leagues, a big publisher. Here's the big problem.
See what he did there? Hey, if you're still working on the second edition of that History of Comics, Brad Geiger's name is still available. He's a big choice.
It's G-U-I-G-A-R. Get it right. No, here's the big problem. And I've thought about this so often because I know I fell victim to it. And I can't tell you how many people shared the same with me. It's Stan Lee's fault. And not in the way that you might think. But Stan Lee, when he was writing those bullpen bulletins, and when he would talk in the 60s and the 70s about hanging out the Marvel bullpen with all of these amazing creators.
Oh, yeah, right. The whole gang hanging out in the bullpen.
He made it sound like everybody was in one big office building together, and John Buscema could yell down the hall at John Romita, and John Romita was, you know, over there giving Joe Simon a swirly.
And they're all pants and ditko and all. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And they never worked in the same building. They would maybe show up to hand in their work. But all these guys, all these men and women were freelancers. They were working at home. There was a brief period of time in the golden age. This guy talks about it in his book very well, where they did have bullpens and stuff like that. But that's going back to like pre-World War II. This idea of a bullpen never existed. In reality. And the problem with that is we got this idea that you'd go to work for Marvel Comics the way I might go to work for Bank of America. And you'd show up, you'd punch in, you'd sit down, you'd do your comics, you'd go home and you'd draw a salary year after year and you'd have a 401k and a retirement. These people were all and always have been freelancers, and they have always been paid terribly
and getting screwed. Yeah, exactly.
We've got deck. And this is the part where I lose patience and I lose sympathy for anyone that's caught up in this, because we've had decades and decades and decades of comics history that you can go back and point to and see dozens, hundreds and hundreds of creators getting screwed mercilessly by this system, getting poor pay, losing rights to the stuff that they created. The freaking creators of Superman had to fight tooth and nail to get a little stipend from DC, and they didn't die wealthy people.
No,
right?
No.
Jack Kirby, who was a primary creative source behind Marvel Comics, did not die a wealthy person. And for you to set your sights on this, as this is the big leagues, the same way a ball player wants to work for the New York Yankees, those are two different big leagues. The big leagues are not that big. And the scary little secret is they never were.
No, it's very much like this. Everyone else in the creative field is like the Muppets trying to go break into Hollywood, right? And cartoonists are Big Bird going the other way, trying to break into public television. Yeah. You know, like, I hope I can make enough money to buy groceries working for public television. That's who we are, right? Trying to break into Marvel and DC and The New Yorker.
Yeah.
I mean, the funny thing is, the same thing of the idea of a bullpen is what I always pictured was the offices of the New Yorker, right?
Yes.
I always thought the offices of the New Yorker would, oh, hello, welcome to the New Yorker. Yes, here's your complimentary espresso. Oh, you're the cartoonist for this week. Whereas every cartoonist, aside from Roz Chass, that I've ever met for the New Yorker, they're all in a one bedroom in way out in the Brooklyn. And they make it in once a week to submit their cartoons. And then they have a very expensive lunch that they can't afford.
Right.
And then they go back to their one bedroom way out in Brooklyn, you know? And so, like, it's not like the New Yorker has that either. And nor is it the case where the syndication has some, you know, magical gates that open up and now you're in a bullpen. Even that, they're scattered all over the country in very affordable places where they can make a living on the very, very small remnant of money from newspaper cartooning. So, it's a lie that's been portrayed as like you'll make, and my heart really breaks, Brad, whenever I meet a really talented cartoonist from Brazil or France who has moved to the U.S. to try to break into Marvel or DC, because I'm like, what are you doing? Oh, you have this is a lie that's now made you move continents. This is terrible, you know?
Yeah. And maybe out of a place where they could get health care to a place where they can't get health care.
So
first of all, this idea of your success means being picked up by a big publisher. Look at all of the effort that this person went into trying to get picked up by a big publisher. The fact of the matter is, and this has been true for a long time now, we don't get to be surprised by it anymore. It's not a surprise. The real success that most people are getting in comics is through self-publishing efforts. It's through doing Patreon, Kickstarter, is through learning how to run your own business. And by the way, you're capable. You can do it. You can learn it. It is stuff that you can do. But that's where people are finding success is a small vanity press has become publishing, and publishing has become what we used to call vanity press. It's just flipped over. The people that are being successful at this are the people that are running their own business.
And one of the signs that you know this is the case is that a lot of quote unquote big publishers are hiring people that have some modicum of massive social media audience because they don't bring anything to the table when it comes to marketing or sales. They're struggling too. They're like, hey, maybe this person with a million social media followers can move some titles for us.
Yeah.
You know, so it gives lie to the idea that some big publisher is going to come along and go now like a little magical fairy with a wand. Now you are a success, right?
Yeah.
It's not. I mean, it happens. Yes, of course. People in Marvel or DC or Random House or Penguin or Scholastic. Yes, it happens. But I would argue that the odds are better for a larger number of people making a smaller but more consistent income that is very livable than the 1 to 2 to 3, you know, catch lightning in a bottle people that make it with Scholastic or make it with Random House or something, you know. And so when someone like this says, I did everything I could for a decade, I'm like, did you? You know, because I want to say,
look around.
instead of participating in the Kickstarter for which you had no ownership, kickstart your own thing. Yes. Instead of working on a small book for which you delivered the art, work on your own book, you know? And I don't know. Right. I my heart wants to go back in time and shake them and say, do it for you. Own your own stuff. Control your own stuff. You know, well, that kind of stuff.
And look around. Part of the thing that had me kind of antsy about that book that I talked about at the beginning of the show is that we've been doing this for 20 years, right? Yeah. This is not a new thing. This is something that's been happening all around us. And not just Dave and I, hundreds of people have been making this work. And it's not new. It's not new. All you had to do was open your eyes and look. Before we go too much further on big leagues, I want to bring up the second overarching.
Sure, of course.
The second overarching. And you knew I was going to say it when you heard me read it, but I'm going to, and we don't have to spend much time on it. Look at all the time and money this guy put into going to comic conventions, thinking that he was networking and promoting. Now, again, we're not going to talk about him specifically here, but I do want to talk about an entire group of artists that are putting in time and money going to these comic conventions. And it's the same thing. Comic conventions, in the same way that the comics industry isn't the way it was in the 1960s and 70s, and maybe never was at all, comic conventions aren't the same comic conventions that we enjoyed in the 90s, in the early 2000s. They don't exist anymore. And the stuff that you think that you're doing there and you think you're going to do there, in many cases, is not going to happen.
Right. I mean, let's break down what this person, because it's true for a lot of people, it was thinking they were going to do at comics conventions.
Yeah.
You know, and the thought is like, I'll go to comic conventions, I'll get portfolio reviews. That's progress, Brad. I'm getting portfolio reviews. Okay, great. Well, that and a drop sandwich on the sidewalk that you can eat will get you a drop sandwich on the sidewalk that you can eat. Like, there's no career in, there's no money, there's no income from a portfolio review, right? The hope there is like seven steps away of like, if I get a good portfolio review, maybe they'll follow up 6 months from now and give me a title. And if I get a title, maybe if I do the work, I'll get paid for it. And maybe if I get paid for it, I'll get invited back and do the title for, like. What I'm saying is, like, I on the rare occasions where I still go to Comic-Cons, San Diego Comic-Con or Emerald City Comic-Con, it's only because I own and control my own titles. I've already invested the cost of goods sold on those books. I'm going to fly out and I'm going to make a few thousand, not make my money back. I'm going to make a few thousand dollars on that show. And then I will have come back with a profit. It was worth my time. You know, all that other stuff, right? And on a limited basis, I only do it with San Diego Comic-Con and Emerald City Comic-Con.
Yeah.
All these other ones where you're hoping on a dream, on a wish to get a portfolio review to maybe then they'll tell you where to find the wizard and the wizard will tell the adventure that you can go on. Like, it just feels like 17 steps to for a full stream is really what I'm getting at, you know?
I don't know. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And again, it's this thing that hasn't been that way for a long time. All you got to do is look around.
That specifically was why I was saying I'm doing nothing and it's not working. It's because you're asking for portfolio reviews to break into an industry that's not going to give you a career or, frankly, a great livable wage, you know?
Yeah. Absolutely. Here's a third thing. And this didn't come up in the Twitter. It came up as I was doing research and I wanted to talk about it because obviously it's something that sometimes gets under my skin. And that's this, this person specifically does have a Patreon, and this person has a not safe for work tier on their Patreon.
Okay.
For all of you people who think that doing a not safe for work tier on your Patreon is as easy as having an ATM installed in your living room, it's a lot more. And by the way, this person can draw 10 times better than I can. Guaranteed. This person is amazing. Is not doing Patreon what I would consider correctly, making a lot of rookie mistakes. We're going to devote Dave either next show or the show after that. We're going to, because I keep saying, we keep talking about Patreon and I'm like, we talk about it all the time. We're going to devote an entire show next week to all the things that you're doing wrong on Patreon that is costing you money. We're just going to go take the first half of the show and go right down them. I've got 9 or 10 things that are common mistakes. I see them all the time. And we're going to talk about that in an upcoming episode.
I'm looking forward to that because I'm due to sort of revamp or revitalize my Drive Patreon especially. And so I'm looking forward to that on a very personal level. So
you'd be surprised how these real simple mistakes can really cost you. But I wanted to take a moment just in general, again, on a broad overarching topic for people to think, well, doing NSFW, you just write your checks. Nope, it's a lot more complicated than that. It's a lot more difficult than just drawing naked people. I'm telling you.
Here's how I know it's more difficult. Imagine how little money Dave Kellett would make if I'm like, I'm starting an NSFW. I'm going to be printing some money. Yeah. How little money would that make? Because I wouldn't know any of the steps that you have to do. I don't know. For the people like, well, you just draw naked people and that's instant cash. I wouldn't know. There's 19,000 things that go into that. But anyway, so, okay, what was the next one that you wanted to focus in on?
I think here's the last thing that I found that I think applies to a lot of people. And that's this, I'm going to go back and quote, I'm incapable of finishing a book on a monthly basis. It's true that I never had to, but I always strive to do for the best I can do. And the best I can do takes too long to make. Now we've got to have a serious conversation. And again, we're not talking about this guy. We're talking about a lot of people who might be in that same position. And that is this. There comes a time when you find yourself in that situation, and you're going to hate to hear me say it, but it's the absolute truth. At some point, you're going to have to lower your standards. That's the God honest truth. If what you do,
that's what my wife had to do. Yeah.
You and me both. Thank God for people who are willing to lower their standards.
She looked around and she said, you'll do. All right, that's fine. Yeah.
But I'm being serious. John Romita Jr. had a great quote that I read just recently that said, what's my style? My style is what I can do on deadline.
Oh my God. Really? Is that an actual quote?
Yeah.
Because Brad, do you remember specifically what I said, if not one show ago, two shows ago, where I was like, everyone needs to be drawing at 70% capacity to work at a faster speed.
Yeah.
And that one of the reasons why illustrators fail at comics so much is because every line has to be a perfect expression of their ability and they can't get out of page. And you had the very smart move of saying, first you get it done, then you improve it, then you polish it, then you put a perfect shine on it, right? But the idea is to get it done first. And so,
but if the clock runs out before you get that perfect shine, then you put out the version that you were able to do.
Yeah. So Romita really said that, huh?
Well, now I'm doubting myself, but I could have swore I saw it.
Do me a favor and just read it again one more time, because I like the sound of that quote.
Romita said, my style is defined as what I can do on deadline.
Holy shit, that's a great quote.
I guess people were kind of giving him, and you know what? It might have come from, we're going to have to dedicate the show to Jeremy Dauber. I think it came out of that book that I'm reading. But at any rate,
is that the book that doesn't mention Brad Geiger, but does mention John Romita and Dave Kellett in very close passages? That's interesting.
And very glowing terms.
Yeah, very. Talked about John Romita's pale, pasty, flabby arms, but Dave Kellett strapping 48-inch biceps, really. Yes, that was great.
Yeah. You had to read in between the lines, but it was there.
It was there. There's a footnote. Yeah, exactly.
But no, I mean, and that is the truth. I mean, and that's, nobody wants to hear that. Everybody wants to say, no, I'm an artist and I've got to put up. No, the fact of the matter is comics is and always has been a revenue-driven medium. It's always been about the monthly book or the daily comic strip. It's always been a commodity. It always has been a commodity. I'm sorry. I know that doesn't sound great, but it's always been a commodity. You're making a commodity. And if you are not making that commodity at a pace that you can monetize it, then yes, you're going to find yourself in another career very, very shortly. And by the way, bad news, the other career, whatever that career is, they're going to have deadlines too.
That's true.
unless your career is in fine arts and you've got one hell of a patron who's willing to, put up, as if it's the Italian Renaissance, you're in trouble. And it's the one thing when I teach my classes at University of the Arts, I'm known to be a very fun teacher. One of the students said that my class should have a 2-drink minimum. We have a lot of fun in that class. But when it comes to a deadline, I tell them all on the first day, I write the word on the board and I say, everything you need to know about the word deadline is in the first four letters. It's a line that after you cross it, you are dead. And I said, listen, I'm sorry that that's the case, but my job is to prepare you for the world you're going out into. And it's tougher than it's ever been. You've got one chance at making it as a professional artist in any career, but especially in comics. You've got to think about this as a Venn diagram. You can be the best at what you do. You can be easy to work with and you can hit a deadline. Your ability to make a career is where any two of those intersect.
Now, can I counter program that thought?
Yeah.
Because here's actually why I like what we do better, which is we set and keep our own deadlines and schedules in what I think is a much more manageable way. Like I look at what Marvel and DC sometimes ask their cartoonists or their artists, working on multiple titles to do X number of pages a day, you know, right?
Yeah.
Or I look at some of these manga artists who are dying of a heart attack at 49 or whatever, because they're just cranking stuff out because they have to. And I'm like, my own mind is like, those market demands are too strong. Yeah. And they don't serve the artist. They only serve the specific scheduling, publishing schedule of that publisher, right? Yeah. And so for me, it's yet another reason why I want to own and control my own work. I own and control how my deadlines are set. So I can set them so that I can make a living and yet make a manageable life for my physical hands. So I'm not ruining my hand, my back. So I'm not ruining
those
my
artist
back.
Hands.
My family schedule so that I can be a present father and husband, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So in so many ways, the life is better, I think, when you own and control your own work.
Yeah, and true. I'll accept that. In other words, there's a middle ground in there between.
Yes,
that,
yes, that's kind of what I'm saying. A middle ground. Yes.
And you're right, because like just the in February, I took basically 2 weeks off to not only write and concentrating on writing the next chapter of Evil Inc., but I also just took an extra week and got ahead so that I was. Instead of posting a black and white preview for my Patreon backers, I'm actually now a week ahead and the previews are in full color and they see exactly the comic that's going to post next week. Well, that's a nice thing to be able to offer, right? That makes those Patreon tiers that much nicer. But I couldn't have done it if unless I had control over my deadline. Now, I was posting other stuff on my Patreon regularly. I did not just go quiet. But you're right in that there is a middle ground there between you've got to have this thing done on a daily or a monthly basis and it'll get there when it gets there. There's a middle ground and being a self-publisher allows you to find that middle ground.
Yeah. And so swinging back around on sort of the entirety of this thread that this person had, but mostly not because it's this person, but because of the thought behind it. Here's my problem with a lot of this is that this person and a lot of cartoonists that I know have spent a decade waiting for someone else to say, now you are an artist. Okay.
Yeah.
Now you will get paid. Okay. Now you're making a living. Now you are a professional. And maybe it is ego. Maybe it is self-belief that's too high, but I don't want to wait on somebody else saying, now, David, you're an artist. Now you can start making money. Now you are a full professional.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like when I control it, I can set myself goals and say, I'm going to do 2 books a year. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do these projects. I'm going to do a podcast with Brad. I'm going to do whatever the hell I want to do. And I am in control, not waiting on some editor in New York. I'm not waiting on some marketing team to push my book for me and hope that they push it in the third quarter like they said they were going to do, or hope that some, a 5-star review in whatever that those book reviews come in and hope that pushes some more titles across the libraries. I don't have to wait on any of that because I control my career. It's a more satisfying way to own and direct your own path. And anyway, so the waiting always frustrates me when I hear somebody like this.
Yeah. So Dave and I, before the show, we're talking about what can we do? Because there is one thing, again, an overarching thing, not only this guy, but maybe a lot of people. Maybe we're in that position where this person might know they're a very good artist, but maybe they realize their writing is not so great.
Right.
And right. Actually, that puts them ahead of, I would estimate, 75% of people trying to do independent comics right now who came to comics because they were artists and don't realize they're not very good writers, you know, and don't know why it's not hitting, because, you know, it must be the algorithm. But I got a clue for you. It's the writing. But maybe this guy, what we were talking, what if you were a situation that, you know, you're a good writer and you know, you're not a good artist, or, you know, you're a good artist, but you know, you're not a good writer. And so we're going to start on the Comic Lab Discord server, a new channel for people who are in that situation, artists looking for writers and writers looking for artists. Because, you know, for every artist out there whose writing is not very good, there's a writer somewhere out mm-hmm. there whose mm-hmm. writing is really good that would love to do comics, but cannot handle the visual aesthetic of doing comics. And if we can help these people find each other, that would make the Comic Lab Discord server that much more of a powerful place.
Right. And it's not going to be the case of Brad and I singing in the background, matchmaker, matchmaker, make me a match. We're just going to provide the Discord channel and let people find one another, because frankly, a dedicated area where you can say, like, look, here's samples of my writing. Anybody have an art piece that they'd like to, or I'm looking for an artist, or here's sample of my art. I tend to like these genres. Anybody work, you know, writing in this kind of thing. Here's some samples, and let people self-direct and find one another, because it's tricky. It's hard in this world to find like-minded artists that are, you know, of a different talent, but in a similar vein to yours. And so I think this kind of Discord channel would be a real service, and we're excited to have that one over on the Patreon Discord server.
Hey, if you're listening while you work, take a minute to stand and stretch.
And while you're doing that, we're going to tell you why you should join us on Patreon.
When you do, you're going to get hours and hours of podcasts that we recorded just for backers.
And exclusive Patreon posts that go even deeper on Comic Lab topics.
And access to our exclusive Discord server, which is a thriving community of professional cartoonists.
So you can support the show you love and get tons of actionable resources for your own cartooning.
And listen, if you can't swing a pledge this month, we get it. No worries.
Yeah, listen, you can still support the show by rating us wherever you get your podcasts.
Just leave a 5-star review and a few kind words.
That, along with mentions on social media, is incredibly helpful.
Now, everybody, let's talk comics.
All right, Brad, we're coming over to our mid-show update. This is where we correct something that we got wrong at the first part of the show, in the second part of the show. And Bradley, I think you have something you need to correct.
Yeah, I came close. Here's thanks to our live stream. Adam over there in the live stream says, here's the actual quote from John Romita Jr. Quote, "I have a deadline style. If it gets done on time, I'm happy with it, period."
Right. The mood, the central idea is still the same, but that's it's good to get that right. So once again, we bring you our mid-show updates where we correct things that we got wrong a mere 10 minutes ago.
And Dave, that means it's time for us to read one of the questions from one of our $5 Patreon backers.
That's right. This comes in from Kipper over at patreon.com/comiclab. And it says, "Hello, Brad and Dave." And by the way, Kipper says, "Dave, congratulations on being mentioned in that History of Comics book. So proud of you, Dave. You're really lifting us all up." Thank you, Kipper. That's very nice of you to write that and to know to write that in this specific question.
More lines that we're reading between, evidently.
So Kipper says, "I recently learned that video game developers divide their audience into early versus late players. Do you think the comic equivalent is archival readers versus casual? Or is this something that's media specific? Thanks for the laughs and the education. And continued congratulations, Dave, on your mention in the History of Comics books." Thank you, Kipper, for that. That's very nice of you, Kipper. So, Brad, this is a really interesting question. First of all, was not familiar that game developers divided their audience into early and late players. But I'm intrigued because I actually do see a parallel, but I want to hear your thoughts first. Yeah.
Well, I saw a parallel too. So let's see if our parallels are parallel. This is a topic that I haven't talked about in a long time, but I'm quite passionate about. I divide my readers mentally into active and passive. I've got active readers and I've got passive readers.
Okay.
And
I don't hate this. I like this. Go ahead. Keep going.
The goal for me is to generate as many active readers as possible. Passive readers are nice, but they're not, obviously they don't lead to a whole lot of financial success. So let's talk about the difference between an active and a passive reader. A passive reader is somebody that you've got that comes to your website or is following you on social media that reads your comic. That's a passive reader. And that's it. That's it. They may or may not buy something, but mostly they're just there for the free comic. And in terms of what they generate for you, once you get past, maybe they help bump your algorithm a little bit in that, you know, maybe they're hitting the like button. There's not much that they do for you. Having a huge following on social media is not very successful. In fact, you see a lot of people, at least I see a lot of people whose Twitter followers, for example, or Instagram followers, far outshine anything that I've ever accomplished on any of my social medias.
Right.
They've got a quadruple, quintuple the number of followers on any social media that I've gotten. And then when I go and I look at their Patreon, they're making $100 or $200. You know, they've got a huge, and I think this is an error. There's no other way for me to put that. I think they've made a mistake in cultivating passive readers rather than active readers, right? And a lot of that comes to, you know, how you're building your social media audience. But the other side of that is active readers. That's readers that are going to, number one, become even active enough to click that like button. That's being a little bit active. But the real action we're looking for here is becoming a Patreon backer, becoming a Kickstarter supporter, those kind of things. That's what you want to generate. That's what you want to cultivate. And that's part of the reason that I'm such a big fan of exclusive rewards on Patreon, because that's a really good way to cultivate that audience, is by giving them something that they can come back for month after month, something that they appreciate. Getting them to become active readers is a huge part of pivoting your business into a place where you're going to have success. The only upside to gathering a huge number of passive readers is that you go that support route, right? That's when you're talking about your $2 Patreon level. And if you've got 100,000 if you've got 100,000 followers, you know that maybe, using conventional wisdom, maybe 1% of them are going to decide to at some point back a Patreon or get involved in a Kickstarter. Well, if you've got so many, then that 1% actually translates into a good amount of money, and you can do really well on a support-based Patreon or those kinds of things, or even going back to the old days of ad revenue. You could do great with ad revenue if you had 100,000 passive readers, because they were going to generate an income. For people like us, however, for most people, Dave, me, most people doing independent comics, what we're after is doing the things that we need to do to generate active readers. So when I think about my readers, the closest parallel that I can come to what this person's talking about is active readers versus passive readers.
Well, that's a very different construction that I was going to launch into, but I'm really appreciative of your angle on this, because A, it's helpful to the discussion, and B, it's my only worthwhile point to chime in on is to say that to get people from passive to active, sometimes you have to provide them very different means to become active. And Brad kind of alluded to this, but I think it's worth mentioning. I know people who don't want physical objects in their life, so they're not going to back a Kickstarter book, but they love my art, so they patronize it on Patreon, right?
Yep.
The opposite is also true. People, they don't like this idea of this every month is a credit card fee, or, you know, it's not for me. Mm-hmm. But God, they get excited for the book, and they'll plunk down $300 on all the tchotchkes in a Kickstarter to get the whole big enchilada, not just the book, right? So once every 2 years, I can get them for a couple hundred bucks. And so And then, you know, drilling down even further, some people don't like books, they don't like Patreon, but they'll like magnets, or they'll like posters, or they'll like prints, or they'll like original art. And so you have to have opportunities, I guess, what I'm saying, or multiple doors for them to walk through, for them to be, to move from passive to active, because not everybody fits into that same square peg, right, of becoming this type of active reader.
Yeah. And that's something that I wanted to talk about, is how do you turn a passive reader into an active reader? And that's something, I mean, again, my head always goes back to exclusives, whether that's Patreon or Kickstarter, which is basically an exclusive reward. But so many times I see people giving away what should be exclusive rewards for free on social media. And it's like, that's the first thing you got to do. Even if it's a portion of that, or a genre of that, a subcategory of that, take some of that stuff that you're using right now to build this tremendously huge, but at the end of the day, worthless Twitter following, take some of that and put it up on Patreon as an exclusive reward. And that's the first thing you do, is because once that person says, wait a minute, I want to see that. If that demand is high enough, you will turn that person from a passive reader to an active reader. Hey, I want to see that. Okay. If I got to get involved on Patreon, I will. It sounds like there's a party going on over there. And poof, you've just turned that person into a active reader who used to be passive. The biggest problem I see, people giving away the store on Twitter.
It's like that old aphorism. People are going to say, why should I buy the Brad when I can get the Brad's comics for free?
Right.
Remember, we all know that old aphorism.
That aphorism we've heard back in the farming communities for years.
I'm not going to buy the Brad when I'm getting the Brad's comics for free. But I actually do want to return. So now that we've heard Brad's distinction of passive versus active, which I think is incredibly helpful to this conversation, I want to take a slightly different attack on this, which is, to return to the original phrase of early versus late players or gamers or video games, right? Which I find interesting, both because just on a personal level, as a dad who often finds himself tired at the end of the day now, in my 20s, I would drop some cash on video games and play them all Saturday or Sunday. Whereas now as a dad, I can check in for 15 minutes every 6 to 7 days on a game. When you know you're in trouble, Brad, when it takes as long to boot up the PS4 as it does for you to actually play your 10-minute session. You know, once you've updated everything and booted it up and got all the settings right, and you're like, all right, I'm ready to play. I'm done. All right. Well, my 10 minutes are up. This has been a pleasure. I've got to go back to doing parenting.
Yes. Speaking of things that have parallels in other parts of our lives as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Once you blow the dust off it and everything, then it's time to go.
Yeah. So I am very much a late player because in gaming terms, I'm not the sort of tastemaker that tries a bunch of games anymore.
Right.
I wait until it's a hit and then I go, oh, all right. Horizon seems good. Halo seems good. Elden Ring seems good. I'll try. Yeah. Everyone seems to like those. I'll try those. I'm not testing anything out because I barely have enough time to play what I got. So I understand this idea of a late player because I am one. Mm-hmm. So now I wanted to relate that to my own comics, which is there's an interesting thing that happens with comics, which is that success begets success. Mm-hmm. And I see that at Comic-Con, San Diego Comic-Con specifically. If I have a crowd, if I have a line of people waiting for sketches or waiting for books or waiting for original art, other people are like, huh, what's going on over here? And they come over and check it out, right?
Yeah.
It's a natural human reaction to crowds is like, huh, this seems, it's like a line for a restaurant. You're like, well, I guess we got to try that restaurant now. People seem to really be willing to wait an hour for that restaurant, right? And so the same thing happened. Beth and I noticed that every year at San Diego Comic-Con. But I also have noticed that, Brad, with Drive, that the more that I have hardcover collections, I'm now on Act 3 with Drive, people go, well, holy shit, I guess there's an actual story here and people are enjoying it. But also it has proven staying power. You know what I mean? In the same way that if a video game has three sequels, you know, well, shit, it must have had enough money to pay for a sequel, right?
Yes, yes.
And so if a book has sequels, you're like, well, I guess it's good enough that an audience liked it, supported it. Like, it's sort of self-evidentiary that it's doing well. And so I definitely noticed that there are, quote unquote, late readers to Drive that are jumping in buying books 1, 2, 3 because they exist now that would not be willing to be, in Brad's term, the sort of passive reader that was willing to give it a try from the start. They're not there for that nonsense. They want to read a semi-finished story that they can believe in. And so the proof is in the pudding when there's actual physical copies of books to be had. What are you thinking about that, Brad? Does that work for you as an idea?
No, I love that idea. I love that idea. I was just sitting there thinking, we talk about mirror marketing versus market research on the show. And mirror marketing, this is another business related decision that my mirror marketing would have given me the wrong answer, right? Because you said, we noticed at conventions when there's a crowd, more people come up. If I would have done mirror research on that, I would have made the exact opposite decision, because I don't like going up to a table when there's a crowd. I would be trying to get rid of the crowd so there's lots of room for somebody to come up unaccosted, right? Right. That was one tangent that I had, is that if I would have allowed myself to do mirror research instead of market research like you smartly did, I would have made the wrong decision.
Well, and just so you know, out of a crowd of 100 people at Comic-Con, 30 will actively avoid a crowd because they, like you and I, tend to be a little bit more withdrawn.
Yeah.
But 60, 70% of the people will actively seek out a crowd because they're like, oh, I'm here to find new things. And this seems to have a crowd. This seems to have a line. What is this thing? How do I crane my neck over here to see what's going on at this table?
Well, and another thing is, let's say here, this is kind of a hopeful message. Let's say that you're having a little bit of a trouble, getting things started. The good news is that as you continue to work and as you continue to do good work and improve, hopefully, you're going to, as you get to that second book and the third book and so forth, you're going to build up a body of work that is going to get some of those people that Dave was just talking about to pay attention to you, right? Yeah. At that first book, maybe not too many people are paying attention to you, but you bring the second book and all of a sudden the type of reader that Dave is talking about takes a look at that and says, oh, this person's been around for two books worth of content. They must be doing something right. You get that knock-on effect that we've both seen after publishing multiple books, where you're publishing book 9 and all of a sudden somebody's there to buy 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, and 1.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, because we all have the people in our life, the reverse of this is true. We all have the people in our life that love to be the tastemakers or the cool hunters and say, I found this band when no one else was listening to them, right? I've been listening to them for 10 years. Yeah. And so those people exist too, by the way. You're going to have readers that have followed you from the start, that they're really excited with every update because they're there in the trenches with you. And it's a personal thing that they've been following since page one and they're very invested in it. And those tend to be the Patreon folks, right?
Yeah.
And then you have these sort of late adopters, if you want to imperfectly model it, those tend to be the Kickstarter folks that jump in, once a year or twice, once every 2 years, get the big collections, and then they're out again. You won't hear from them at all. But so you have both. But this is a really interesting model. Now, as far as like, what do you get to take away from this? The takeaway, unfortunately, is do your best work. But put out the best work you can, make the best comic you can. You're going to get some people early. You're going to get some people late. Yeah. If it's helpful to you to think that way in terms of your marketing, great. But it doesn't change much about what you do with your average comic. We're still putting out best updates that we can that on a standalone basis are wonderful and produce a satisfying result, whether it's a joke, whether it's a moment of drama, whether it's a character twist, right? Mm-hmm. Every update has to be satisfying. And you're also writing for the book so that it all ties together in a long form collection. So again, nothing really changes about what you're doing. But again, this is an interesting thought experiment of early versus late readers.
Absolutely. So, Dave, as we're wrapping up the show, I've got one that I think we can probably knock out in a very short order. Okay. This one comes in from our friend Alan Gladfelter, who says, I just saw this asked on Twitter. Is it better to run one $18,000 Kickstarter campaign or three $6,000 Kickstarter campaigns? And I think when we're talking the numbers there, we're talking about the goals, not the final amount of the campaign. So you're running one Kickstarter that the goal is $18,000.
Oh, I see.
Or would you rather run three Kickstarters with individual goals of $6,000 each? Which is better?
I don't know if this is helpful, but this is the thought that popped into my mind. It's like asking that question of, would you rather be killed by one horse-sized duck or 4,000 duck-sized horses? Which one would you rather be killed by, Brad? The problem is you're killed by both of them, right? So both of these Kickstarters, you net $18,000 at the end of this.
Yeah.
And in some respects, in many respects, in all respects, that's all that matters is that you've made $18,000 at the end of this. Some people will have a business model and a art style and a final product that is beholden to one big swing that generates $18,000. Mm-hmm. And some people will have content and final product and a lifestyle that they can only do three smaller Kickstarters. But both ways could work. Both ways could make $18,000. So I see no problem with either one. Brad, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, we're on the same page here that the idea that there's a one-size-fits-all answer to this question is just silly. It all depends on who you are as a person, what kind of business you're running, where you are in your career. There's 100 different variables. They're both good. Running a successful $18,000 Kickstarter is wonderful. Running three $6,000 ones is fantastic. Obviously, the $18,001 might be over more quickly. But then again, you can't even judge that, right? You could say, oh yeah, well the $18,000 one, I'm gonna be done quicker than three $6,000. Not necessarily. It all depends on how those Kickstarters are structured.
Yeah,
there's a lot of variables in there.
I mean, the more likely thing is if you're making $18,000 versus $6,000 Kickstarters, mm-hmm. the bigger Kickstarter is most likely a project that took more work. And what I mean by that is, yeah, you made all that 18 in one swing, but now you have 2 months of book pre-production to do for it, right? Whereas the three $6,000 Kickstarters were magnets and pins, and that, you know, it took a couple of quick passes on art files and not gonna eat up your spring, right? So, for example, Brad and I with Comic Lab for funsies, we do Kickstarters every once in a while. There's no archive of comics for Brad and I to put together in a book. There's no massive collection that you can now. So we do small Kickstarters that are magnets, pins, fun tchotchkes, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the way Comic Lab has to work. When Dave Kellett or Brad Geiger kickstart, we have full comic collections that are years long efforts that need to be bound into big books. And so those tend to be bigger Kickstarter swings, but both work and both can be made to work for a career.
Yeah. And listen, if you're trying to work for a career, you're in the right place because you've been listening to the Comic Lab podcast. And that's what we talk about here every week is doing the things that you need to know to become a working cartoonist.
And your hosts have been my friend, Brad Geiger, not currently yet featured in the history of comics, but he's still got hope. He's got two chapters left to go, everybody.
There's still time.
Keep Brad in your thoughts and prayers. We're still hoping for it. He's the editor of webcomics.com and the creator of Evil Inc. at evil-comic.com.
And my friend, the mentionable David Kellett, the co-director of the comics documentary Stripped and the cartoonist of Sheldon at sheldoncomics.com and Drive at drivecomic.com.
And, you know, not to belabor the point, but I would have thought Stripped would have gotten the mention, not Sheldon.
Mention for Stripped yet. No mention for Stripped.
Maybe it won't be. You're mad if you don't get mentioned and you're mad if you do get mentioned.
It's such a true moment. I would be doing the same thing. It's like, well, why didn't they talk about this other stuff? That is one that needs mentioned there.
It is funny how human we are. Anyway, the Comic Lab theme song is used with permission from Andy Creighton at theworldrecord.net. And this episode was edited by the always wonderful Matt Woodard of Woodsong Productions over at www.woodsong.media.
If you love Comic Lab, you can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts, and you may hear your review featured on a future episode.
And Comic Lab is made possible by your kind and continuing support at patreon.com/comiclab. So we'll go ahead and say that like Brad's mentioned in the history of comics.
Oh, you son of a bitch. Oh, was that you?
Yeah, that's my dog. So let's hold on. That's the contractor arriving. Hold on 1 second.
Yeah.
Let me just say to the dog.
Are you texting your dog?
I'm texting. You son of a bitch.
Tack, 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 tack. Ollie. Tack, tack, tack,
Ollie,
tack,
Ollie.
Deal.
Tack, tack. Find a joy inside your heart. This is not who you want to be. Hey, Ollie. Ollie. Ollie, look at your life choices. Ollie. Ollie, reexamine who you want to be. This is not your best self. Calm down, honey. There we go.
I thought that was the one that was going to work. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh.